Look at the distortion in the air in front of you. See it fold and ripple, the way the light glistens off something that should not be there. Can you catch a glimpse of what is on the other side? It's called a wind door, and will take you to places both like and unlike our world. This one will take you to the 10 worlds of New Century, as written by Alex Shaw. Come with us on a journey through the wind door. White Scarves Old and New to Through the Wind Door, and our penultimate episode discussing the New Century story, Let Them Go. This episode we're going to be discussing the final five chapters, which comprise what is essentially part three of the book. The remaining five chapters basically include two different parts of the story and how they mesh into one. And obviously, that's going to include the final climax and resolution of all the events that have occurred up till now. But in addition to that, we are going to have a final episode where we can discuss the entire story as a whole, and especially focus on storytelling themes and genre themes. As I've mentioned before, neither Toby or myself have any kind of superior knowledge about Gothic as a genre. And over the course of this review, we took an opportunity to become more informed, watching certain movies, considering staples of Gothic literature, and looking at a few intriguing links on the internet supplied in part by Wikipedia. And therefore, me and Toby are wanting to have a larger discussion as to how Let Them Go does or doesn't fit into that genre, and that is likely to just have us expound for a good long while just unpacking the various details and working together with that.
But I mean, we're all about looking for any and every opportunity to expound long and into the night, and hopefully a Wendigo won't disturb us in the middle of it. But
that's the problem, is we get into these long discussions and then a Wendigo attacks and we have to deal with that, and it's just annoying.
Yeah, it's why there's a gap between recording sessions, viewers.
I'm sorry. We didn't want to give this away, but yeah, the only reason why there's such a long distance between each of these issues is that we're constantly fighting off hordes of Wendigo, and it's really becoming an annoyance, but, you know, we do it for you.
Yeah, I mean, Greg does most of the heavy lifting, to be honest. I just stay behind and pick off the stragglers. It's also, we have to find new Vox tubes every time we finish, and they're very few and far between. But we've got a couple of pairs now, and that should see us through to the last two episodes. So we're all set up.
All right, so I noticed that whenever we start getting into the synopsis of the thing that happens, it's very easy for us to digress in different directions. And while that does mean
last episode was a rather perfect case of that, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, because we were just like, every time we started getting into a piece of the story, we started going off in one direction or another, and it was like, oh yeah, this is on my list of topics that I wanted to bring up, so we might as well bring it up now. And then by the time the podcast ended, we're practically like, oh yeah, and these here are the final events of the actual book, and there's nothing left or very little left on the list that hasn't already been covered by our meandering rambles. So I'm just going to go through the actual events of the story and then just dive from there into the topic list that I wanted to take care of. So we'll just try and get this all done in one go. Obviously, I don't necessarily know how y'all listeners respond to the various ways we end up tackling this, because this is still, even though we've done several recordings now, we don't yet know what the actual structure of the podcast is going to be going forward. You know, this is us playing it by ear and me trying to come up with some sort of structure and format so we don't go completely off the rails. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. To begin, So when last we saw Rebecca, she had successfully locked Dawson in the basement and was just completely exhausted and wanting to reconnect with her sister, even though she does not seem to be responsive behind the door. The way the story itself leaves it is that she is just so completely stressed out and tired that she is supposedly retreating to a place in her mind that is less stressful. As it turns out, well, yes, she may be remembering a simpler time, and there may be gentle and compelling elements to it that might make her smile. As events actually play out, we suddenly discover that things are not quite as simple as one would have expected. And if there's one thing that you can always count on Alex for, is to make things not simple and unexpected. We've already had several different occasions of this throughout this story in particular. There's going to be plenty more of them to come.
Yes, there is definitely a case of providing the necessary breaks in the story of something like we need a cup of tea and a chance for Rebecca and Aunt Cleo to talk, and it's going well, it's going exactly the way you need it to. Oh no, a Wendigo attack. And in this sequence here, where we begin with a sort of memory of a pleasant meet cute between Rebecca and the gentleman that she mentioned to Dawson, that was the one person in her life that turned her head and she formed a long connection with. And it feels, oh, this is exactly what we need. We needed something that wasn't tense as all hell and making our anxieties sort of peak. And then the penny drops, and you realize exactly who this gentleman is. If you hadn't picked it up from the audio drama version of this story, the voice actor may sound familiar, and it's because this gentleman, when he introduces himself after getting his two suspenders, was it? Or his two
No,
bracelets?
it was his bootlaces.
Bootlaces, that's it. And after getting both of them attacked by Rebecca's dog, and it's a wonderful scene. She introduces herself, and then he introduces himself, and he says he's Rafe Culver. Oh.
And now everything is.
Oh.
Yes,
Oh.
I when you originally wrote your blog on this, I was reading about how you were typing out. It's like, oh, and I was wondering if you were going to vocalize that for us. So well done.
Thank you. I won't take us off track too much, but I will say that although revisiting this, we're both aware of how the story plays out, so we understand from the beginning of the scene. But when I was first listening to this, there was a period of uncertainty. As the scene goes on, I thought that is that Rafe? And I was pretty sure it was, but I thought, well, Alex does use different voice actors for multiple characters, and so it wasn't a sure thing until you hear the name, and at that point, it's just a million things come into focus for the first time. That's kind of the only word that kind of summarizes everything, is just oh.
Yes. Well, but see, that's the thing, is that we know that it's significant, but it needs to let everything else play out over the course of these next two chapters for us to understand the significance of what exactly happened. Because all we know at this point is that it is Rafe, and that from what she said earlier to Dawson, that it didn't end up the way one would have hoped. But as things play out, one understands why things happened the way they did. First, as you say, there's the meet cute, there's the two of them getting back together later on that day and connecting with each other. They go out, they have a meal, and it's clear they have a strong emotional affinity with each other and that they're both intelligent in ways that the other appreciates. Rebecca is already, unfortunately, getting in her own way of why this can't possibly be a thing for her. And then, before we can even take a breath, the drama goes to 11, as they return to find her mother has collapsed from some sort of serious medical event. They refer to it in a different term at the time. I think apocalyptic convulsions or something like that. I forget the exact term. She's had a stroke.
And I think they refer to it as something like a paralysis, which leaves her left side or her right side, but one
of her
half
sides. Yeah, exactly. As it turns out, we got there together. The term in the book is apoplectic paralysis, and apoplexy is actually an ancient term for what we now refer to as a stroke.
The toll this has on Rebecca, you can kind of see immediately after they come back from this very sweet, very low-key date, which is kind of why Rebecca, despite the stress and tragedy of the rest of this sequence of connected memories represents in the narrative, you can see why she would, despite her better judgment, indulge in remembering this date and the meeting before it, because they are very sweet moments where there really were very few cares that she had to deal with for most of her life, if we're honest. The aftermath of coming back and discovering her mother on the floor, when Rafe asks what he can do, Rebecca's curt responses and Sharon's performance, which takes a lot of the warmth out of what was previously there in the chapter beforehand, you can absolutely tell that she blames herself, and she sees it as, I wasn't here when this happened because I talked myself into this and because I indulged, this happened. And I think she kind of forgets that her mother was the one who was pushing her the most. In her mind, it came down to her decision, and the fact that she made that decision, it means that it's all on her. And it's the exact sort of same sense of blaming herself far too much and putting too much of the onus of it as with Timothy, when she blames herself for everything that happened with that, when it was a whole series of circumstances conspiring to make the worst happen.
I think that's definitely something worth reflecting on further due to the way it relates to past events and conversations in the story. But before we do that, let's get back to the events in progress. So Rebecca's mother has a stroke, and the immediate events as such after that is that Rebecca now has to step forward and damage control and fix whatever's going on here. And even though Rafe's presence should be potentially helpful in some ways, she refuses it. Likely for many of the reasons you just mentioned, guilt over her choices, and the fact that his presence will be a constant reminder of giving in to weakness. It's also possible that she worries that she won't be able to be as strong with Rafe present. So the next time things develop between the two of them is much later on, and he's actually coming in and doing the hugely romantic thing of bringing her a ring. As I recall, was it his grandmother's ring?
That's right.
And actually going down onto one knee, thinking, you know what, this is something that I can do. There's emotion behind it, but there's thought behind it as well. So he goes in there trying to sate both his own emotional desire, as he feels it would be reciprocated by her, but also because he's a man that's in search of not necessarily a problem to fix, but he wants to be of use. That's very much a characterization of Rafe, is a desire to be useful to someone else. When things go badly, or more precisely, when Rebecca turns him down for, you know, understandably legitimate reasons, the very next thing he does is end up going off to war and becoming a soldier. Unable to do the thing that he very much wanted to do with Rebecca, he doesn't immediately go back off and try to have a normal life again. He feels a calling to try to do something else, and that something else is perhaps to be a soldier. There could be multiple feelings behind that. Being a soldier isn't really a safe job. So maybe there's his choice to go off to war.
Side.
Yeah, there could definitely be an element of that in there. It's not something that ever gets fully explored. The point is that he disappears from Rebecca's life, and when he finally returns, it's with the unexpected development that the man that she regretted saying no to for years has, through the cruelties of fate, managed to come into contact with Amanda and fallen for her instead. That is almost textbook, the definition of adding insult to injury, even though it's nobody's fault. And yet, once the air has been cleared, the drama gets resolved with surprising ease.
They both want the same thing, which is Amanda's happiness. I think that's what makes it as easy as it is because for as much as this kills Rebecca, in the same way that she accepts responsibility and the hardship of looking after her mother, she accepts the hardship of this so that Amanda doesn't have to.
This is like repeating a pattern, then. Whether the crisis is a large one or a very personal one, her automatic response is just to accept the pain and endure for the greater good. If it's her own pain, then she can deal with her own pain. She couldn't bear causing additional pain to Amanda, who did nothing wrong. She doesn't want to cause additional pain to Rafe either, because this isn't his fault. He points out during their conversation he was under the impression that Rebecca had a different last name. It's definitely the first time the two of them have seen each other, because she has this hugely emotional reaction when he arrives, and her immediate assumption is that somehow Amanda found out about him and brought him back to her so that she could correct what she feels is her biggest mistake. And then Amanda shows off the engagement ring on her finger, and Rebecca immediately understands she was wrong, but locks down that emotional response like flipping a switch. Only once they are in private is the tragedy fully revealed, and the two of them resolve to bury the truth. The emotional moment rends them and us in twain, and it leads to an interesting liminal space that I wasn't sure existed until I compared audio drama to novel. When the story is moving from flashback to the present, there's this line, and I'm forgetting the exact wording of the line now.
I could never hate you.
I could never
It's
hate you, yes.
because Rafe says, in return, I hope that you can bring yourself not to hate me. And the sort of closing fade is, I could never hate you. And
Yes.
it's that lingering line that transcends time that brings her to the present. And it's kind of the line that encapsulates everything.
Exactly. The way it's framed in the novel, she is coming out of a very vivid memory and saying the line in the present the same way she said it in the past. I didn't necessarily realize this in the audio drama itself, because there isn't a clear boundary of where flashback ends and present begins, so I like the additional context the written version provides. In addition, I suspect the reason why this vivid memory is what she retreats to in spite of its tragedy is that at the very least, she is remembering Rafe during a time when he is alive, as opposed to now, where all possibilities for the future of any kind are now gone because he's dead. You know?
Hence my, it's just that sort of everything falling into place where you suddenly find yourself in a position where you go, oh man, I hope this all works out. And you know it doesn't. You know it doesn't. It's a knife to the gut after a Wendigo already ripped it out.
So, we, the audience, have now been given our moment to breathe again, even if that breath includes us choking back a sob. And that done, the Wendigo now come back into the picture, and more specifically, as the title of the next chapter itself says, into the house.
She hears the breaking of glass downstairs, and
Right.
that happens just as I forget exactly what is happening, but I think she's sort of considering Amanda's door and Amanda's room. I don't know if she was about to take action, but at the very least, I think she was thinking about what's to be done. And that's when she hears the breaking of glass, and we have the first sort of action sequence of this last part of the book.
Right, so she's confronting, I guess, Elsie.
No, and... Elsie is the last one later on. At this point, it is the male, as she refers to it. And
oh, right, as, yes.
As you astutely pointed out, it should be William Smythe, was that his name? The fellow from the prologue section.
It was here that Toby and I had an extended discussion about who the identities of the three Barghest were. The original digression was cut for time and clarity, but my assertion was that besides Cavendish, who Cleo had already killed, the other male Barghest couldn't possibly be Smythe, because in the prologue, the implication was that the female that attacked him just killed and ate him, rather than leaving him with a survivable wound that would result in later transformation. The conclusion that we agreed on was that the other male must have been the coach driver that was ferrying Elsie away from Ravenwood, and that the female that attacked the Barghest in the prologue must have been some other woman that Cavendish infected. However, there is another possibility that Alex dropped on us like an anvil just a couple of days ago, and I'll insert it when we get to that part of the story, because, man, it is a doozy.
She encounters the male Wendigo, and it's after a tense sequence where it frames the darkness as an almost Lovecraftian sort of cosmic horror. Like, everything is described as eldritch. Rebecca realizes that what the fear of the dark comes from is that idea of when everything is in darkness, you forget, you can almost forget what is out there, and so it becomes this amorphous and unknowable thing that you struggle to dispel. And so when the male Barghest appears, it is this fantastic visual of this beast just suddenly coming out from the dark, and every horrible detail is illuminated by the lantern before it's blown out and it's unknowable again. It's a creature of that darkness.
You are literally fighting the darkness.
Exactly.
As things play out, she manages to use the tools to hand in order to be able to protect herself. But the effort takes so much out of her that when it sounds like the Dawson Barghest is escaping from the cellar, she cannot muster the wherewithal to keep fighting. She gives in to flight instead, hides under the sheets in the master bedroom, and hopes for the end to come quick. But she doesn't have a complete mental breakdown. Or if she does, it takes unusual forms. What begins as an argument inside her own mind turns into an almost supernatural moment, as it seems like the ghosts of her family are there in the room with her, haunting her, arguing one way or another towards a course of action. They talk about the significance of the outside as the place where things happen, as opposed to inside that room under those covers and being stifled by fear and inaction. Bad things happen outside. Good things happen outside as well. If she goes outside, she has options, whereas if she remains paralyzed under the cover, she has none. The various ghosts, they don't so much have opinions that are reflective of the people that they belong to. They're really more reflective of, I would say, Rebecca's own brain.
We can be fairly sure that Aunt Cleo or Timothy or Rafe would never talk like this to her or at her. They seem to much more embody what Rebecca fears they might think of her. And that's why I think the anxiety of this scene is very relatable in a way, which is like, this is kind of the climax of the story. It is everything that we now know about Rebecca coming to a head and her having to confront it. And there's so much at play where you could, given the gothic surroundings, you wonder, are these ghosts really here, and or are they just a part of her mind? And in so many ways that doesn't really matter, because I think that the way Alex writes these ghosts is very similar to how ghosts are discussed in Guillermo del Toro's ghost story duology of The Devil's Backbone and Crimson Peak, which we will talk about a lot more. But for now, I want to kind of zero in on how ghosts are kind of said to embody so many things, and not just literally spirits of the dead. They can represent things which linger. And I think that at this point, Rebecca is confronted by all the things which linger about her connections to all these people. And if she wants to get out of this room again, in every sense of that phrase, then she has to confront these ghosts.
Well, it's not just that. I feel like, as far as horror stories in general are concerned, one of the ongoing tropes, particularly when we, if there are discussions of, say, the final girl, which is a common trope in horror movies and stories of the like, there tends to be a female protagonist that successfully manages to fight back against the monster or the creeping horror or the supernatural, whatever it is. And while the tendency is for them to survive at all odds, sometimes after the victory comes, there is a later defeat, and they don't necessarily make it out of alive. So we don't know until it actually happens. We don't know whether Rebecca will survive the night or not. But the climax, as you say, the actual confrontation with the antagonist is not the bar guest itself, not the multiple bar guests, but is her own despair and her own guilt. She needs to overcome that before she can do anything else, before she can even hope to rally a defense. And she makes the decision to try because, yes, while she has carried this guilt with her so long, that is an indelible part of her makeup. It has affected her choices and affected her life on so many levels. If she gives into it now, then there is no hope left at all. And Alex won't have that. We've got to have hope here. So she makes the decision to try, and that makes all of the difference in the events coming forward. Only after listening to this during edit was I reminded of a moment from one of my favorite shows, The Good Place. Not the show itself. While it's an amazing show worth watching, it is not at all like New Century, and its main protagonist, Eleanor Shellstrop, is nothing like Rebecca Wolverton. But like New Century, it had its own podcast while it was on air. Run by one of the other actors, he had all the actors, small and large, scriptwriters, creators, set designers, prop people, and everyone else on to talk about the experience. And one of my favorite people to listen to was the actress who played Eleanor, the very funny Kristen Bell. This is a clip from said podcast where Kristen talks about what is in Eleanor's head about becoming a better person than she is.
I think Eleanor Shellstrop is really good at working a program. Mm. Like, when you have a problem, let's say it, like, to compare it to sobriety or something like that, you are going to have that problem forever. You are always going to want to drink. Mm-hmm. Always. Every single day of your life. But if you apply working a program and you say, I'm only going to not drink today. I'm only going to try today. I don't have to think about 15 years from now. Right. I'm just going to try today. Whether you're working with grief or some sort of obsession or some sort of addiction. And in Eleanor's case, the addiction is to being selfish, is to choosing herself.
Right.
You just have to apply working a program. And Eleanor's program that she's decided to commit to is just to try. So sometimes she loses, but sometimes she wins because she wants very much to say, Chidi and I, let's just go. But she doesn't because she's very good at remembering her program of all I have to do is try and assess the situation as if I were a better person. Mm-hmm. What would that person do?
The reason why I decided to edit this in and why I feel the working a program is an eye-opening metaphor to use is that while it's important that she is able to make the decision in the here and now, there is no saying that she won't continue to struggle with it in the future. But every journey starts with a first step, and when that first step determines life and death, this is, for all intents and purposes, Rebecca finally achieving closure.
And that's why, in the sequence of events, the final part isn't the thing outside, it's the thing inside.
Dun, dun, dun! Yes, well done. You did the title drop. Not quite the title drop. No, the title drop would be if I accurately said that it is in this penultimate chapter that Rebecca decides that if she is going to survive, she has to let them go.
I guess we were the new century multiverse we made along the way.
Oh, yeah. Oh yes. All right. So
after she lets them go, sorry.
She comes to a confrontation with... So there are several monsters left, but obviously the monster that Dawson was and has now become sort of looms larger than any of the others. So naturally, once she makes the decision to fight for herself and to overcome her despair, that's the thing that immediately comes into play, like Jack Torrance beating down the door with his axe, although in this particular case, it's just the Dawson Barghest beating down the door with his fists. It's a very easy association to make when that scene is already mimetic, even to those who aren't fans of horror. The scene, of course, doubles down on the imagery when Rebecca stabs Dawson's hand, the same as Wendy Torrance in the movie. But unlike Wendy, she is no longer reacting from a place of helpless terror. She keeps the barricade in place and goes at the Barghest with a hammer until the beast is finally brought low.
It's quite an image where he's kind of clawing and halfway through. And it's the case that if he managed to fully come into the room, then I think Rebecca would have been done for. But it's the fact that she manages to pin him down and keep him trapped. She literally doesn't let him in. She stops him at the gate and bludgeons his head in. She
you
turns.
You shall not pass. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. It's not quite as majestic as a magical spell, but you know, she does.
Goodness, no, fighting for your life isn't necessarily pretty, unfortunately. If this story were actually put onto screen, I'm sure that certain aspects of it would be particularly bloody. But Dawson is brought low, and now that she's done this, she realizes she's got to go out there and kill Elsie as well. But it's also during this final chapter that she realizes that it's very likely at this point that Amanda has also turned, and that as so many other things are, Amanda is her responsibility, so she's got to kill the thing that Amanda has become as well. And that brings us to the final chapter, where there is an apropos bookending of chapter titles. When we originally got to the chapter titled A Man's Work, we all groaned at the insulting use of the term, especially given the man that was supposedly going to do the quote-unquote work. But when the final culmination of the story is a woman's work, we all want to cheer. This is the point where Rebecca makes her transformation into Ellen Ripley and gets the shotgun and the coat and ladens herself down with supplies and ventures out into the unknown to do what she must, trying to protect future innocence from being brought low by a monster that they didn't create. But Amanda is still Rebecca's sister, so her ongoing self-image is still about taking responsibility. So she is taking responsibility for her sister, even though she views her as being dead now at this point.
You've touched on multiple times the idea of agency and the lack thereof that is fluctuating all over the place in this book and is often examining the lack of agency that Rebecca and a lot of women who would be in her position have in this present world. And now that the world's kind of come crashing down, it's a moment where she rises from the ruins and, having faced what was inside, she's able to make her first steps outside to the place where things are the result of her own agency. So that's why I think this last chapter is as much of a triumph as it is, even though when you actually look at everything that happens on paper, it's like, okay, do we have a lot to work from here? And the answer is yes, we have something, and that's enough.
However, there is one final complication, and it makes for a different kind of nonlinear storytelling than Alex has used previously. It is one part staggered flashback, one part semi-Kuleshov effect, and one part vivid memory, because while Rebecca is looking for supplies, she finds a very unexpected letter from Amanda that affects her so deeply that the story frames it as echoing in her mind as the events of the chapter take place. She has ostensibly read the entire letter from beginning to end, but we don't find out what the contents of the letters are except as events in the real world take place. So it's like almost as if that final letter is not narrating what's going on here, but it is a narration that is going on in Rebecca's own head as things play out. One of the things that I noticed as she gets the shotgun, she kills the Elsie Barghest and proceeds to go into the woods in order to hunt down the Amanda Barghest. Unlike in previous chapters, there is not a whole lot of internal reflection right up until the end. We get a chance to see inside Rebecca's head a lot as she is considering what is going on, trying to make sense of things, but the thing that is accompanying her now is not her own internal thoughts, but are the final words of her sister, which I feel like may play into how things actually develop at the end. We find out in this final letter is that Amanda was aware about her and Rafe, not necessarily from the beginning, but from a lot longer than any of us may have realized. The two of them basically made a pact that Amanda was to never find out about what's going on there. But Amanda isn't stupid. She has a great deal of emotional intelligence. And as she relates in the letter itself, she talks about how while at first she thought the standoffishness had to do with Rebecca being Rebecca and being protective of her sister, it's only until she gets more of a sense of how they are together when they are together that she realizes there is more going on there. This letter was not written prior to coming to Ravenwood, which is, again, something I had forgotten until rereading this chapter. It is something that happened immediately after she ordered her sister to get out of the room. Something in what Rebecca said got to her because she was talking about Rafe and how she would want to count on no one else. And there is a loss of control from Amanda or just an emotional beat that she chose to interpret from what Rebecca was saying. And it made her angry and jealous. Only once she calmed down and came back to the core of herself was she willing to say, look, I love you both, and I understand that there is something between the two of you that does not necessarily include me, but certainly doesn't include me in the way that this current setup of me being married to Rafe and you being the odd person out with nothing but your work, that's not sustainable to me. I can't stand that. Therefore, I'm willing to stand aside for you and Rafe. And all of this happened prior to Rafe dying. That makes all of us die a little inside, knowing how all of this played out. We're coming to an end of the story, and at the very least, Rebecca survives. But Rebecca has lost as much as one person could have lost. And even getting past this moment to survive and to fight the Barghest and to do the work, it doesn't change the fact that in the days, months, and years after this, she is going to end up having to do a great deal of rebuilding herself.
That's exactly it, because I think this letter kind of represents just how much has been lost from this, because it wasn't just everything of Rebecca's present, which, let's be clear, she, as along with a lot of other people on this fateful night, lost everything. But it was also the potential for the best possible future that she could have hoped for, wanted, whatever, in that past life, the future with Aunt Cleo that's gone, the future where Manda and Rafe approached her and said, we'll sort this out together, that was gone. Mm-hmm. And now this ultimate gesture from Amanda to step aside and let Rebecca and Rafe be together, that can't happen. That is almost as concrete as you can get as to something which acts as evidence that this is a different timeline, that this is such a radical event that has happened that everything is different now.
If the Barghest hadn't shown up, then it's entirely possible that at this point, Cleo might have moved in with the two of them. They would have sold Ravenwood, which would have been the best for all, because it was really a symbol of a time and of emotions that wouldn't help any of them move forward into the rest of the world. Change the marriage over and may potentially have still all lived together. That could have been a happy ending. There would still have been a lot of drama and conflict and all that sort of thing like that. But that would have been an ending that would rival the most romantic stories and movies out there. None of that is for them. That is all gone. That is an alternate reality that will never happen. It hammers away at all of us. It's the final nail in the coffin of an old life as Rebecca has to go out now and forge a new one. These are all the complex thoughts going on in our heads. But it's likely having a similar effect on Rebecca, because the letter paralyzes her at first, and she is only able to jar herself back to action when she sees the Amanda Barghest outside. I posited earlier that the words in the letter may be racing through her head as she hunts down her prey, but on second consideration, this may also just be a narrative conceit by Alex. Instead, she may well be trying to feel nothing at all in order to get past these paralyzing thoughts. She hunts into the woods to find Amanda, to do that one final act to close all of this off. And then we get to the last unexpected twist here, where she's facing off against Amanda in the tree, and Amanda is fully a monster now. It's easy to call her a monster, but I feel like, honestly, the way the two of them react to each other, at least the way Amanda is reacting to Rebecca, is not as being this thing without remorse that kills because it wants to, or even necessarily because it's hungry. She's acting like an animal, not necessarily trapped. The two of them are confronting each other, but Amanda is not attacking, and Rebecca is standing there feeling like she has to kill Amanda and finding herself unable to do it. If Amanda the Barghest had actually attacked Rebecca, then that would have cut things cleanly. Bang, the gun would have gone off and there would be proper closure going on there. But instead what happens is Rebecca finds that she can't do it and basically slowly retreats back towards the house, leaving Amanda by herself, and that's where the story ends. That's a very difficult ending. It doesn't leave us with the same normal level of closure, particularly that would happen in a horror story. And I'm curious to get your take on what this ending means. What is going on in Rebecca's head? What is the ending trying to say to the reader, do you think?
So I think a lot is unsaid, and that's the point. The only words that Rebecca actually says to Amanda is, I found you, which is also, I believe, what she said to Timothy when she found him in the stump, in the hollowed out trunk.
Right. Just beneath her.
And I think that adds to her inability to kill Amanda, because what is she going to kill another sibling where she, the last one that she lost, kind of met his end, even though he came back to the house and died of pneumonia there? It's just sort of that setting is magnetically pulling both of them there. And so I think the fact that she finds her here is probably just about enough evidence to know that although this thing is no longer Amanda. There is just enough in her that she can't bring herself to kill that last part of her. So, I mean, that's the sort of text that is explicitly what Rebecca in the narration says and reasons out as to why she does what she does. But I think it is definitely this moment that is meant to be representative of this splintering of these two people who were connected and now belong to different worlds, because even though neither of them are acting on whatever aggressive impulse they might have, Rebecca knows that the right thing to do would be to kill Amanda, bring her out of whatever existence this is, and to prevent her from causing any further harm to anyone she might happen upon. Even though that is the responsible impulse inside her, she can't act on that. And we've seen exactly how these creatures act, and yet Amanda isn't acting on that drive. So there is something paradoxical about this moment, and that's why I think that there is a sort of, I mentioned a magnetic pull to that spot, but what's kind of happening there is like two like ends of magnets sort of repelling one another where they can't quite connect. And so it becomes this moment where they can't act aggressively to one another, but they can't coexist in this space together. They can't, it is impossible. She can't just start like bringing Amanda along and looking for a cure with her. It just cannot work. They are literally on different levels, with Amanda high above in the tree while Rebecca is grounded and still has her 2 feet on the earth. So it becomes this uneasy situation that she has to just simply walk away from. And she gets to a stream and has to look down at her feet while she crosses the stream. And once she has done that, Amanda is gone. And I think that stream is very much meant to represent that for as long as Rebecca stands on that side of that stream, she is in the same world as Amanda, but she can't be there, so she has to cross over into this new world. And as soon as she does that, Amanda is gone to her. It's like I say, it's one of those uneasy paradoxical endings where you know what ought to happen, you know what should happen, and very specifically the last words of the penultimate chapter are, there was only one thing left to do, which is the same words that ended, I think, the second chapter when they were talking about there was only one thing left to do.
Before their lives could begin, yes.
Exactly.
I didn't remember this at the time because I was caught up in Toby's compelling interpretation. But unfortunately, the line, there was only one thing left to do, was not the end of the chapter, Thy Shade, but rather the chapter just before, when Rebecca was set on waiting for the end to come. That doesn't make Toby's interpretation wrong, and the reuse of the line was very possibly still deliberate, but I wanted to correct the original conversation just for clarity's sake.
I think that in both situations, their lives have to begin, but like, that line is almost a precursor to, okay, there may only be one thing left to do, but that thing may not actually happen in the way that you expect. Killing Amanda is something where you know this should be what happens to bring everything to a neat close. But I think that what's been made readily apparent from everything leading up to this point is that things can't be a neat close. Everything is uncertain, and that is why they kind of lead off and the world is open and it's unknowable.
Or actually, not quite unknowable. This fan podcast is Toby and I interpreting the story using the pattern matching capabilities that we possess, but something that the casual listener may not be aware of is that Alex likes to talk. I like to let people talk who like to talk. It makes it easier to find out if my theories about his books are correct. What this means is that Through the Wind Door is not completely a pure death of the author experience. Toby and I know a lot more about Alex's intent than the average reader off the street, and that means that our understanding of his works are not unbiased. But let's be honest, no one is without bias, and trying to divorce oneself from it is foolish. If our narrative experience is closer to the author's intent, that doesn't make it bad. That said, while Alex's explanation for why he chose the ending he did is actually quite moving and poetic, I'm choosing not to repeat it here. Those who know, know. And if you chat him up, you may well find it out yourself. But our remit in making this podcast to begin with was an attempt to start talking about these stories ourselves without continuing to use our access to Alex as the word of God. It's what he himself wanted, for these stories to grow beyond him, and let all of his fans be free to decide what things mean. You, listeners, are also free to have your own interpretation that doesn't line up with ours. But we do hope that our discussion assists in helping you do so. Well, first of all, let me just say that that entire thing that you just laid out there was a fascinating conversation of of logic and poetry there. I wouldn't necessarily clued into some of the same things. So well done there.
Thank you.
But your words did bring up two thoughts for me, one at least that had already been partly present when I had been considering this same question myself. Amanda would be the one that knows more about symbols. And Rebecca wouldn't. She's always been the practical one, and Amanda has been the imaginative one. Just as you say, based on the text itself, the thoughts in her head was, this was her sister, she couldn't pull the trigger. It may very well be on some level that while she may had to let go of her guilt and she may had to let go of her fear and of the ghosts that were holding her back, the symbolism of not letting something go but instead killing it may have been more than she could ask of herself. And that doing so would be killing a part of herself, killing those things in her that are representative of Amanda in her very essence. If she'd already lost so much, you know, at least leave her something left of her soul. The stuff that you talked about just now made me realize that there is something more fundamental going on that literally relates back to other stuff in the story, and more specifically relates back to those flashback chapters, which is that Rebecca always... she categorizes herself as being the one that does the right thing. You know, it was the right thing to continue to support the family, support her sister, and support her mother during difficult times, regardless of what she has to endure in order to be able to do it. Therefore, going out and killing the Amanda, the rest of the Vargas, including Amanda, was the kind of decision that she would have always made prior to then. This is maybe the first time where she allows herself to respond to her emotions and therefore acts according to those.
You're absolutely right.
So this is not a rebellion precisely, because her choices in the past have always been what she felt would be best for herself as well as for everybody else. Her rebelling against her father was specifically in not wanting to marry because that's what her father wanted of her. But in order to be true to herself, she had to approach everything from a logical and pragmatic standpoint, and this is her finally not doing that, regardless of what the consequences may be. And we don't know what those consequences are. As you eloquently put during your analysis of the situation, life is messy. It doesn't always lend itself to being put into these neat little boxes and have everything resolved. So Let Them Go is meant to be a little bit of a commentary on that, particularly when we respond to things emotionally. It doesn't always mean that we make the right decisions, but in this particular case, it may have been not the only decision that she could have made. It is meant to be a reflection, I feel, of what she is trying to save, or that she is now becoming something other than that she was right there in that moment in choosing to act based on her emotions and not based on her pragmatism or her intellect.
Yeah, that's why it's also another reason why it's such a great place for the story to end, is because it is this fundamental difference in her disposition from who she was before, and what drove her doing this is something where she can't possibly know where this will go in the short term. It is the fact that she made that decision at all will have ramifications. It means that not only is Amanda going on to uncertain futures, but that Rebecca is going on to uncertain futures.
Yeah. I still very much like our interpretation wrapped up in psychology and symbolism, and making us feel like Rebecca did the right thing for herself. After all, one bar guest more or less wouldn't necessarily have changed things, even if she didn't know that. But it also means there is another potential consequence of her choice. When we were discussing the identities of the various bar guests earlier, I promised a twist that Alex posited to us just yesterday. Why am I revealing this, and not the explanation I mentioned earlier? Primarily because the mindfuck is that good, and it feels apropos to a horror narrative. But also because you don't have to take this as gospel. Think of it as a thought experiment. What if the prologue was actually an epilogue? What if the Bargess that killed William Smythe was not some unknown woman, but was, in fact, the bar guest formerly known as Amanda? So, for those of you that are not aware, listeners, there is an epilogue that comes at the end of the credits for the audio drama, but for the purposes of the book, there is a commentary by Alex saying that the story of this world will continue in secret rooms, and Rebecca Wolverton will one day return. There is also a From the Author blurb. But after all of that, if you actually scroll to the back, there is a final stinger. There is a final epilogue that is framed around that hatch that was in the cellar of Ravenwood that Rebecca had certain thoughts about when she was younger and used as a stalking horse in order to get Dawson's attention away from her. But here, the hatch is standing open, and that leaves us with a question of what significance does that actually have? We already know that Dawson is dead. Is this an implication that the ghosts that Rebecca faced off again are in some form real? Is there something worse in this house that we haven't even seen? There is a certain potential, not necessarily Lovecraftian, but definitely additional supernatural, like, ooh, what's going on here? And there are going to be epilogues in the future that, much like the I'm here to talk to you about the Avengers initiative, ones like those that are going to be hinting at books to come or ideas to come or even just, you know, little things that may or may not come up. And we have no idea where this hatch is going to play in any of this. This very well could just be not even necessarily a larger universe style stinger. It could just be the kind of stinger that will sometimes happen in horror movies in general to sort of leave us with the last sense of dread. Like, you know, the idea, oh, the monster's not actually dead, or just because you've survived the night or survived this one event doesn't mean that there aren't worse things to come. So it lends itself to that kind of a trope, and we don't know if any of this is going to ever come back, but it definitely leads one to wonder. New readers aren't going to know about the way events play out in the United Kingdom as far as the ongoing bar guest menace. For all we know, this one lonely house in the middle of nowhere, and perhaps even Amanda herself, could still come back in some form. I get the feeling like on some level, Alex himself doesn't even know. One of the things he likes to talk about is that in order to be able to create tension and drama, he has to leave everything on the table in terms of how things are going to play out, who's going to live, who's going to die. He can't always put people into neat little plot protective boxes. He needs to be able to be afraid for his protagonists in order to be able to put them into actual danger in his books. So the idea that he might eventually find an interesting way to come back to this is enticing. It's also going to be terrifying on some level, because goodness knows this particular book was definitely hard hitting on a number of ways. And my experience in listening to it in the audio drama was part of the reason why I had to take a break during some of it, because it was just, I was too emotionally overloaded and it was getting to me, and I needed to put some space in between there. I wouldn't necessarily have felt as much that way if I had begun by dispassionately reading it as text on a book, because I am one of those people that has difficulty visualizing things. I don't have vivid sense memory as, say, Rebecca might have. I sort of need the help of the voices or the sounds, or in the case of a movie, the actual need to be able to see what's going on, or at the very least, see enough to get my imagination to start working on its own. But if you just tell me this is the way something looks, I sometimes have difficulty actually picturing it in my head. Anything that's written down that I'm reading, there's more of an emotional remove that's going on here. So therefore, listening to the audio drama or, say, watching an actual horror movie complete with violence and screams and gore, this is not the kind of thing that I tend to go in for, because I react strongly, viscerally to that kind of thing. But I'm very glad to have read this book, because Alex put together something that was so compelling that it got me to engage with something that is not my milieu, and basically was like, okay, well, if he can do this well with something that I would not normally want to engage with, then the rest of it's got to be amazing.
It's hard logic to fight with that, because it really is one of those. It's such a strong conclusion to this first narrative, where it really closes everything and satisfies. Like, I often fall into the trap of discussing Let Them Go as like a starting point for the rest of the stories, and talking about how it gives you so much of a sense of the writing style and things, and it comes at a point where Alex has really sort of hit his stride as a writer and kind of knows what he wants to do with each story. But what I often fall into the trap of is forgetting to talk about how this experience in and of itself works as well as it does. And I think it is because, unfortunately and fortunately, it hits very hard. It really does just take so much of your empathy and establishes it, and then after bad things happens, adds layers, not in a way that feels cheap, as if it's sort of retroactively applying extra tragedy. It's more like it sort of shows you a detailed picture. Everything is contained within the frame and you're able to understand everything. And then at a certain point in the story, the camera just zooms out and you get to see more of the picture and you understand how it fits in. It doesn't feel like it's tacked on. It's just that you are now seeing the full picture when you didn't realize it was there. As a result, it creates this experience which is haunting but also inspiring. I think that the very best sort of stories where awful things happen end on this note of, for as bad as things got, the characters still kept going forward. And I think that's the ultimate note of Let Them Go. And in fact, the story title itself is about the positive step forward that Rebecca makes by the end of this story. There's so much that is lost, but even though that happy ending that we talked about is existing in some alternate timeline, in some ways, while that would have been amazing and everyone could have healed, I think Rebecca still makes a huge step forward. And like we talked about, that's embodied by her taking that decision. As far as this story goes, that decision, I think, is representative of how Rebecca has changed. And I think that this is positive change, that she takes charge of herself.
Yeah. Some of the things that we have left on the list there, I think, I may leave until our final conversation, even though they have direct influence on specifically the chapters that we've been talking about today. One of the last things that I wanted to talk about, at least a little bit, we may end up getting more into it next time on Through the Windor. Next time! one of the things that Rebecca tends to identify herself as, especially when she's first talking with Rafe and then making the decisions that she does, her reasons for choosing to not pursue that, they are well thought out. I mean, she very much understands the world that she lives in and the consequences of responding emotionally or unthinkingly to whatever life presents you and everything like that. We understand that. We empathize with that. And we don't want to see her being taken advantage of by, not to put a too fine point on it, but by the patriarchy, by men that are able to abuse the status quo to make things more difficult for her. She's already playing against a stacked deck, so to speak, and she's going to do whatever she can in order to retain as much agency as she can given her situation. By the same token, the flashback first puts into perspective, while she seems to be happy, while she is responding to certain aspects of her chosen path, as in, this is something that she can do, it's something that she's good at, it's something that she takes a degree of pleasure in to an extent. As things continue to play out, particularly in regards to conversations that Rebecca has with Jane, her mother, more things start being revealed, such as the choice that the family made to send Amanda abroad and not Rebecca. The argument is never made explicit, but the implication is that while Amanda now has a great opportunity to learn and experience the world, it isn't for its own sake. It is instead to find a good husband for Amanda to settle down with, where Rebecca would actually want that same opportunity instead to make something of herself. Rebecca would only want to go out and do these things if it was a way of furthering her own agency. So my overall impression from it is that on some level she felt trapped by having to continue to be there and having the running of Haversham's be the only method by which she could find some level of satisfaction and fulfillment and happiness and power, even as she fights so hard to retain it in the initial chapters of the book itself, when she's attempting to make the arrangements with Mr. Galloway, and why she ruffles so hard at the idea of the place being sold in order to cover her father's debts. She has made this very much a part of her identity, and so therefore she rails at anything that would take that away from her, but it doesn't mean that it's clean cut. And I feel like this insight into 5 years into her past is reflective of that. When you were talking about Rebecca being punished for her brief choice to actually indulge on this fancy that she can't explain as regards Rafe, she is responding to him on a gut and emotional level that doesn't happen to her often. Her mother encourages that because she knows that Rebecca is unhappy, even though she's really unwilling to admit that, because doing so means that she is not losing a part of herself, but she has to cling to this part of her life in order to stay sane and stable to a certain extent. But she went and she did something that was not like her because her heart called to it, and then she felt she was punished for it by what happened to her mother, the one parent that she could count on to be on her side and to be her advocate and to care for her. And now she is having to care for her mother. It makes everything more complicated and only makes her feel more and more like she has to be this way or bad things will happen. And that's not a rational thought, but she believes on some level that it is. That's why she makes the haunting decision that she does to not accept Rafe, because she worries that giving into that part of herself will result in further calamity, even if it doesn't feel like it right now. Like, no one could have expected the stroke happening. Rebecca is like, are you sure you're going to be okay? You know, you seem like you're tired. But I mean, you know, like, people normally get tired. I get tired after work every day. That doesn't mean that I'm about to have an apocalyptic fit or a stroke or a brain hemorrhage or anything like that.
So, you know, there was the event with the dog. There's a actual, like, tangible thing they can point to, and she says, that's why I'm feeling this way. So there's nothing to say that that isn't the case.
Yeah, so the thing that I am reflecting on then, and this is going to definitely get brought up more when we start talking about the story as a whole, is that Rebecca's entire modus operandi is to hold on to whatever power and agency she can, even as it seems like the world is attempting to deny her of it, merely by the framework and structure and society that she lives in. But it also occurs to me that on some level that she is doing the same to herself and feeling like this is the only life that she can have. And how relatable that is when we all feel like we have responsibilities to our friends, to our family, to even just some internal metric
compulsion
that we hold ourselves up to say, you know, this is me. And if I'm not true to me, then what am I?
I think that's exactly it. And I think the phrase that always jumps out at me whenever I listen or revisit that chapter is when Rafe is coming to her and asking for her to marry him and for them to share their lives together. She says, my life is not something I want to share with anyone right now. And that's, she doesn't mean that in a selfish way. She means that in a way where she does not want to put any of what she's dealing with onto someone else. And that's something where I think that kind of logic means that you don't see how sharing that with someone can help. As we were saying earlier, Rebecca is someone who, if she has the option to deal with hurt or pain or responsibility so that someone else doesn't have to, she'll take that option, and in fact she'll insist upon it. That means that for as much as she works towards securing agency for herself, because that's part of her identity, I think a lot of us have these competing impulses, and they're often seem to be in two different directions, but they're joined by almost the same motivation. And it's, for her, she wants agency so that she can maybe take control, but she also, in order to secure that agency, takes steps and does things which kind of put her into this self-made trap that stops her from making these choices that deep down she knows she wants to. But if she wants to do what she wants out of life, she tells herself she can't, even though it's all to chase agency. So it's all twinned together. And if I sound like I'm low energy and the wind is coming out of me as I say it, it's because that is it's one of those scenarios that does draw that response. It's infinitely understandable, and yet it's also the sort of thing that you see as an outside reader and you lament it. And when at the end she finally steps out into the world to kind of take some measure of control, and we see the first decision she makes with that agency, we can't help but feel that this is a good first step forward.
Yeah, no, this isn't something that we can relate to at all. It's not like I don't constantly feel weighed down by familial responsibilities or to my friends, or that I feel like I have to go in and be an ideal employee and always put in 110% because I worry that, not necessarily that my job might be on the line if I don't, but that I'm going to let someone down and have that emotional weight on me as a result. Yeah, no personal resonance there at all.
Yeah.
I feel like this is a relatively good stopping point. Speaking of responsibilities, I have some of those that I need to be taking care of post-haste. But I did just want to leave with one last thing. When you were talking a moment ago about happy endings, just something came to mind that is one of my favorite quotes of all times. I never actually read the book that, or if I did, I don't remember it. I think I own it somewhere. But one of my favorite movies back from when I was a little kid, and that I loved when I was young and had a greater appreciation of at like when I was a teenager and then when I fully became an adult, is The Last Unicorn.
That's a good one. Brilliant.
The favorite quote, and the one that I was actually carrying around with me for a while as being the tagline to all my emails, was that there is no happy ending because nothing ends. That is very much a good capper to the experience that we're having here with the story of Let Them Go and Rebecca and all that sort of thing. Her story is not over, and there is no happy ending. There is merely a pause before the rest of her life can begin, so to speak.
Progress.
There's progress. But by the same token, the circumstance under which that line is spoken in the story, it is presented as an argument for doing the selfless thing rather than the selfish thing, that the unicorn has to deny her own happiness for the greater good.
The greater good.
I've got to stop saying that. Anyway, the brilliant thing is that our conclusions would let them go is basically the inverse of that argument. And it kind of makes me love it even more, that being selfish is somehow the better thing to do, even if one wouldn't consider it heroic. It feels like another example of Alex flipping the script on us. And the best part of me using that term, flipping that fucking script, that's a term that I ended up getting from the We Hate Movies podcast. Wasn't from one of their discussions on one of the movies they love or anything like that. It was in a discussion of the movie Eraser and how they were commenting on how, this movie really flips that fucking script. Eraser is just this ridiculous, overblown 90s action movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger. But, so it's hard to say exactly whether they're saying it tongue-in-cheek or whether they mean it with any kind of affection. Even though it's a crappy movie, the We Hate Movies podcast people seem to really enjoy certain aspects of it. I feel like that's unusually synchronistic because I would have never have started listening to We Hate Movies if it were not for Alex himself. So.
Yeah, and speaking of film discussion podcast and Alex, it occurred to me when you used the word interesting earlier that one last observation I'm going to make is that he slides into one of these chapters something that any listener to School of Movies will be well aware of, is his disdain for the word interesting as a sort of, and I love the phrase he uses in this chapter where he says that it's the very pawn of diplomacy or something like that. Having said that, I want to apologize and not sound like I'm jumping on your use of it, because any listener who wants to settle a score will probably go back and hear that I used it far like exponentially more times than you did, so apologies. I will try to use that word less frequently.
Well, when Alex is commenting on that word, he's always saying, like, you know, if you're going to use the word, please follow it with more details, because by itself it lends nothing to the conversation. It's like someone saying that they're fine. It's so thoroughly a neutral word that doesn't actually explain any of your thoughts or feelings. So I would say that our listeners, I would hope, they would feel that we are providing plenty of details here to back up our use of the word. I don't know that I can completely eschew it from my vocabulary there. But
absolutely. And actually, to be honest, any listener, just listen back. I don't think I say interesting so much. It's the word absolutely. So it's interesting that I do that.
All right, now we've completely collapsed the waveform here.
Thank you. All right, close the window. We're done.
Close the window. We're done. Yeah, exactly. So that brings us to the end of the recap of the chapters. Next time, we are going to be talking about the story in total. We're going to cover some of the stuff we already mentioned in passing in greater detail, now that we can discuss all parts of the story. We're going to be discussing gothic horror and gothic romance and how the story does or doesn't fit into those tropes. And we look forward to seeing all of you on the next trip through the Windor. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And for the penultimate episode of Let Them Go, we're going to try something a little different for our end music. School of Movies likes to have relevant songs from soundtracks for the end of movie discussions, and the Let Them Go audio drama itself ends with the song Force of Nature by Gavin Dunn. So I thought I'd contribute a piece of music I came across recently that encapsulates my feelings about Rebecca and what I hope is further success in her new life. Performed by The Score, I would like to present Stronger.
I don't do this for the riches, I'm infected, my condition is I'm always in my head. These words are my religion, I'm obsessed, it's by decision, I'ma do this till I'm dead. Set me on fire, set me on fire. Whoa, whoa. I'm still alive. But you didn't think that I'd come back to life. Stronger, everlasting, how you're fast and never crushing.